Let him know.
The savior
let him know.
Of the broken, the beaten, and the damned.
Oh, here we go, Mike.
I got the drums.
Welcome to this week's edition of the NinersNation.com Better Rivals podcast. My name is Oscar Aparicio, and this week it is another Womp Womp Wednesday. I am currently putting my hands out demonstrably, gesticulating wildly, but luckily I'm not putting any of it on film. And with me, as always, is one Mr. Jared Brown. Jared, how you doing?
I'm doing good, man. Fired up after listening to that carpool karaoke. That's just fascinating stuff.
Dude, so that was, if you haven't heard it yet, that is both Mike McGlinchey and Joe Staley singing a song in the car, and you have to see Mike McGlinchey get after these drums. I mean, there's no literal rhythm there, but it looks remarkably impressive.
It really does. He is not holding back by any means, and that's a big man in what appears to be a small backseat, bright red, and going for it. An impressive bit of knowledge, like the two tackles both having such control of that song, was really impressive.
I mean, I don't know if that was control of the song, but it was certainly a song, I guess. Do you know what actual song that was? This is where we're going to get real deep in the trivia. What do you know what song that was?
Yeah, it's the Black Parade song, and I can't think of the the name's gonna escape me. I can't think of the band. I can see the singer's image in my mind. Like, it's like the pseudo Jack White, but it's not really Jack White.
It's My Chemical Romance.
Oh man, 14-year-old Jared is not gonna be happy that he forgot that.
Yeah, I love how Joe Staley's just along for the ride. Like, you can tell he's just kind of humoring his little brother, and his little brother is just getting after it. It's really, really funny. But yeah, that's the kind of week it's been. Carpool karaoke, more interesting than the game, because the game kind of turned out to be, well, it was fun for a minute until it wasn't, because the Niners ended up as the runners-up in the Bosa Bowl. They lost another close one to the Giants. Final score was 27-23. They blew a 10-point third-quarter lead, and really it was just generational talent against generational talent. It was Matt Breida versus Saquon Barkley. It was Nick Mullins versus Eli, two Super Bowls. How the hell did he do that, Manning? And it's just, you know, it was the passing of the torch, really, from old to new.
I think that's a wonderful way to put it. I think this game lived up to exactly the kind of marquee matchup that we predicted. Two running backs selected in the top 10, both with equal abilities and skill sets, showing out on Monday night.
Yeah, that's how I feel about that game. It's time to crack a beer. Because really, my first takeaway from the game is that the offense is really performing as well as you could hope, given the lack of quality quarterback play. Folks, Nick Mullins is limited as an NFL passer, and Kyle Shanahan absolutely knows this, and you can tell by his game plan. I think Nick Mullins is a great story. It is. I think Mullins Mania is a much better nickname than Big Dick Nick. Become original with your nicknames, people. Come on, don't be reductive. You're better than this. But when you look at his passing chart, you look at everything and it's clustered under 10 yards. And if you're between the numbers, you can see maybe a few shots into the intermediate area. But Kyle Shanahan is leveraging play action boots, RPOs, quick throws to the flats to really keep Nick Mullins in his comfort zone. He was 14 of 16 between the numbers and up to 19 yards downfield. And so as long as you keep Nick Mullins in that box between the numbers, you know, under 10 yards or maybe a little bit deeper if you're between the numbers, then you've got, you know, what looks like a functional quarterback, but things get a little dicey outside of there.
They really do. I think some of it is mechanical, and some of the areas of the field that they try to push the ball to occasionally, he just doesn't have, in buzzword, but sort of the arm talent to do it. And as always, credit to Kyle Shanahan, who, it's hard because there's sort of this duality of another game lost and a game that they probably should have won against a bad team that they were playing well against. But the sort of the caveat is that he's doing this with his third string quarterback, at least in the beginning of the year, the backup running back with a defense that's not, you know, doesn't have Reuben Foster on the field and what they thought he could be. So Kyle Shanahan, in terms of managing the overall story and sort of season, is still doing well. And it's hard to, you know, routinely acknowledge that when it's another loss. But given all of Nick Mullins' faults, or rather deficiencies, they're doing well. One thing that seems to be the problem with me, and it's fairly minor, and Kyle Shanahan has been able to sort of scheme around it or play call around it, but when Nick Mullins goes to hit some of these deeper throws, particularly out towards the sidelines, the ball that was intercepted, there's also a ball a couple weeks ago that you could, you know, just nearly intercepted and always sort of late and inside. But his arm mechanics get really sloppy, and I think it's because he knows that fundamentally he doesn't have the arm strength to drive those sort of throws at the NFL level. So what ends up happening is that as he goes to separate, he sort of raises his front shoulder up. It's kind of like, you know, I imagine like a 7 or 8 year old kid kind of learning to throw a football, and they really rear back, and that's what Nick Mullins does in a sense. It's obviously not as, you know, demonstrative and wildly obvious, but he does it just enough so that as he comes to bring his hips through, he can't really drive over the top of the ball. And what ends up happening is the ball hangs longer when it really should begin to sort of dive down and really begin, you know, come down more towards chest height. And you'll see a lot of these balls are, you know, 6 or 7 inches above the receiver's head and inside. They're dangerous throws, and Kyle Shanahan doesn't let him make them a lot, but every once in a while, he's going to have to.
Yeah, I think when you look at his interception was the case in point for some of what you're describing, where he's got to get the ball out to the sideline. And whenever you're a quarterback and you need to make a sideline throw, the number one place that you cannot put that ball is inside. If you're going to miss, you have to miss out wide, because then at least no one gets it, as opposed to it hitting inside and then you've got a deflection, ball careens up, and now all of a sudden you've got a gimme in terms of some points for the New York Giants. And I think that not only is he limited physically, but Nick Mullins also begins to become non-functional under pressure. It's the same kind of thing that we saw with C.J. Beathard, where in the pocket, in a clean pocket, they're decent, they're okay, they can at least manage the offense, but once you start to pressure them, they become non-functional. In a clean pocket, Nick Mullins was 24 of 30 for 238 yards, a touchdown, and a pick. He was only pressured on 9 plays, including the final play where Mullins thought he could just get bonus points for hitting the upper deck. He was like, hey, you know what? Let's just go ahead and try to dunk it off the upright, because that's what quarterbacks are supposed to do. But the Giants really didn't do a whole hell of a lot of pressure. But when they did pressure him, it was bad. He was only 3 for 9 for 12 yards when the Giants actually generated pressure. The offensive line actually kept him upright. They did what they were supposed to do. But on like the 9 occasions out of the 30 or so plays they didn't, Nick Mullins just basically fell apart.
And what that says to me is that they rushed his decision-making process, and then, you know, fundamentally all that sort of stuff broke down. And the reality is, you know, Nick Mullins is not a long-term starter in the NFL. He could be a viable backup, and he may actually draw some trade interest, at least at some point during his time with the 49ers. But at some point, you know, teams are going to recognize that that's sort of the MO to beat him, and he's going to have to learn, even this year, this is not like a down the road learn this sort of thing. He's going to have to begin getting comfortable with this. And of course, the 49ers coaches see this as well, but the Giants, as you mentioned, didn't bring a whole heck of a lot of pressure. When they did, though, it was wildly effective. And to only complete 3 passes for 12 yards says that the decision-making process flares out, and he ends up hitting those checkdowns or their shorter routes. More than anything, he's not able to really push the ball down the field. Some of that could be moving, and without a clean base in the pocket, he doesn't, you know, that limited arm strength shows up even more, and he really can't drive the ball. But identifying where that blitz is coming from and then isolating the areas of the field where he can get the ball out quickly and still, you know, get positive yardage and continue to move the sticks is important.
Yeah, I think really the thing that jumps out the most at me is that Shanahan has cobbled together a functional offense with Beathard and Mullins for the majority of the season. I mean, at this point, you've got, what, 6 games with Beathard and Mullins and about 3 or 2 and some change with Garoppolo. And the fact that he's cobbled together what even looks like a functional NFL offense is pretty remarkable. The 49ers are 18th in points per game this season. They score on average 23 per game, which is the highest number of points per game the Niners have scored in the last 3 years. Take a guess at how many points per game the Tom Sula, you know, firebrand offenses were scoring.
I'm going to guess that Tom Sula's offenses were scoring not that well. I would put them somewhere around 14 to 15 points per game.
That's exactly right. It was 14.9. So you were right in that area.
Yeah, and that's a really good guess. And I lowballed that. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Jeez, that's bad.
When we think about, you know, coaching, and we talked a lot about it on the bonus podcast with George a couple of weeks ago. I think I posted it on Friday. So if you haven't given that a listen, check the feed. It's not going to be on Niners Nation. It's going to be on the feed specifically for the people who subscribe. So get on that subscription. But take a listen to that, because we talk specifically about how your head coach elevates a lot of what your players can do. And that's what we're seeing with Beathard and Mullins. Mullins is limited as an NFL passer, and yet the 49ers offense and Kyle Shanahan specifically are able to get the most out of Mullins to make the Niners be in this game. And that's not nothing. That's good coaching. And I think that, you know, ultimately it is what it is. You're looking at two backup quarterbacks, both of which are, you know, they are what they are. They're backup quarterbacks, and yet the Niners are at least competitive. And at this rate, I think the outcome of the game, if you're looking for the future health of this franchise, yes, it sucks to lose, but the elegant tank continues. You get closer to the second overall pick, which is looking likely that it will be at this point, the second overall pick. And it sucks losing, but you got to rationalize it as a fan somehow. And right now, I'm just going to start watching film of the draft picks, because that's what the team should really be looking for.
They should. As you mentioned, Kyle Shanahan has done an impressive job. And again, it's hard because there's this sort of duality in losing, but still trying to identify what's working well. Very few coaches could routinely keep their team competitive with backup quarterbacks. And in addition to that, these are not, you know, Sean Hill at the end of his career savvy vet backup quarterbacks. This is CJ Beathard in his second year, who was not known as some prolific passer coming out of Iowa, and Nick Mullins, who went undrafted and was largely unknown until his first time actually seeing regular season action. So these are not, is this not like a veteran backup quarterback that's been in the league for 10 years and is sort of serviceable, you know, when they were sort of throwing out names like Kellen Clemens coming in and stuff. The fact that Kyle Shanahan has continued to keep the offense, you know, relatively afloat, given who is at the most important position in the league, is really impressive. And it's encouraging. You know, I don't know if the what's showing up is so much because Kyle Shanahan's doing so well with players that are very limited. Like, making Nick Mullins and CJ Beathard look good seems to really highlight Kyle Shanahan's strengths, and I don't know if we'd see that quite as much like with a quarterback like Jimmy Garoppolo, who seems to have some natural talent and ability. You know, what Kyle Shanahan can do might not be quite as highlighted because some of it is also attributed to Jimmy G being good. But nonetheless, you see what Kyle Shanahan can do from a schematic standpoint. And more importantly, I think in terms of evaluation, he's showing that as a coach, and one of the most critical areas is identifying what your players can do and then putting them in a position on the field to do it and still have it be enough to beat teams or to compete with teams. And he does that week in, week out.
I think you're right. I think when you're thinking of team building at this point, there's a reason that the John DeFilippos of the world and, you know, the Matt LaFleur, who is from the Shanahan tree but is now the offensive coordinator in Tennessee, there's a reason that those coordinators and you know, now eventual head coaches are the popular picks, because quarterback is the most important position in football. And if you have a quarterback who understands that position, who can tailor their offense to bring out the strengths of that player, then you already have a leg up above, say, like, I don't know, the Steve Wilks of the world, the defensive-minded head coaches that we don't know if they're going to be able to, you know, fix a quarterback or create a situation around a quarterback that's going to make them succeed. So I do think that from a team-building perspective, Kyle Shanahan gives the 49ers a leg up in a way that other teams are looking to go find. And we fortunately have a head coach that can do that. And so, you know, I think it's just more fuel to the fire of, in no way should he be on the hot seat. This is actually the fact that the Niners are competitive is really a testament to what Kyle Shanahan can do with a quarterback, with an offense. And I think that, you know, it's we're probably belaboring the point at this point, but it's something that's important. This is a team that is competitive, not in spite of Kyle Shanahan, but because of Kyle Shanahan.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. that they are routinely in games because of what he does as a coach.
All right, so the question that I think becomes, okay, so if they're in games because of what he can do for the offense, and if we're, you know, talent starved and talent deprived, then why the hell are we then giving up the games near the end and end up with all of these close losses? Why is the elegant tank even a thing? Well, quite frankly, it's probably on the shoulders of another set of defensive lapses. And there were a couple in this game, some of which were highlighted already, some of which were just like just head-scratching moments. And I think the first one, of course, was that the pass to Odell Beckham Jr. that was the first touchdown where everyone's just kind of staring at the quarterback, and then Odell Beckham's like waving and making a pot pie in the back of the end zone and ends up catching a touchdown for I think, the Giants' first score.
Yeah, it was not a good look. And these are sort of the same routine adjustments, or rather misadjustments, that aren't happening with sort of core schematic issues in this defense, or sort of core principles of this defense that just don't seem to work out week to week.
Yeah, I think when you look at that TD, the Giants come out in 11 personnel. They line up 3-by-1. So one tight end, one running back. They line up with three wide receivers on the left, and then the tight end, Evan Engram, on the backside. And what this does is it forces the Niners defense to check to Mabel. This is a classic Saban adjustment. And basically what it does is it creates a zone defense on the side where you've got trips because you've got three receivers over there. And then you actually have man-to-man coverage on the backside against the tight end and the running back. And that's exactly what happens. Sherman ends up manning up Evan Engram. And then Antoine Exum Jr. ends up covering the running back. So now you've got zone coverage on the front side where you've got three receivers. And you've got numbers. You've got people that can actually cover. And the problem was that they all had their eyes in the backfield, and they were essentially spot dropping. And spot dropping in the NFL is going to get you killed. Ward and Williams don't communicate. They don't pass off Odell Beckham Jr. And as a result, he just floats into the back of the end zone. Jimmy Ward, who is not threatened by the underneath receiver at all, that you've got two linebackers on that route, ends up just staring at Eli Manning, and they're in the red zone. They're in a condensed area. He doesn't have the speed. I don't think anyone has the speed to cover the ground he would need to cover to get to Odell Beckham Jr., and it's an easy pitch and catch touchdown. It was not a terrible call in that area. It was a good adjustment based on the formation, and yet instead what you have is players not communicating. They don't have proper eye discipline. They're not understanding the concepts and the routes that are threatening them. And as a result, you've got a dude who's wide the hell open for a touchdown.
It's just a general lack of spatial awareness, really. And Williams almost actually made the play sort of at the last moment, recognizes, I think, where Eli wants to go with the ball and begins to drop a little bit more and gets his hands up. He's not a particularly tall player, and so he just doesn't have the length to affect the pass in any way. But as you mentioned, I think it's Eric Crocker on Twitter who he often mentions this idea of sort of covering grass versus actually covering players. And while, you know, the sort of base defensive formations are almost always built out of what kind of coverage it is, 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever, you know, to spot drop it where you say you go to this area and you go to this area and then sort of just read quarterback's eyes. That stuff works in high school, but it doesn't work in the NFL, where every NFL passer, I mean, baseline, every NFL passer is able to read those coverages and throw with the necessary, most of them can throw with the necessary touch and anticipation. And obviously Eli Manning has some arm concerns late in his career, but I don't know how you leave a receiver like Odell Beckham Jr. This is not some fourth string wide receiver that you lose track of. This is the guy on this offense. I don't know how you lose track of him. And more importantly, like you said, this is it's a miscommunication, but more importantly, it's a lack of spatial awareness. It's not understanding situationally what they're threatening you with. It's a lack of basic fundamental knowledge of route concepts and where your help and leverage is, and sort of all of these things that we see happen week in, week out. It's not every single play. It's not the worst defense in the league, but when you have five or six of these kind of lapses every game, and some of which have cost you games, it's a problem.
You know, we kind of had this saved for a little bit later in the agenda, but I kind of want to dig into it now, because the debate between kind of scheme and execution for this defense is one that I think is important and can be really instructive. I was really surprised to find out that the Niners are actually 18th in defensive DVOA after week 10. They're actually 17th in weighted DVOA. That means that their defense overall, according to DVOA, which is defense adjusted value over average, is about middle of the pack. And that really surprised me. I was looking at that and I was like, this does not look like a middle of the pack defense, right? And so I'm thinking, okay, why? What the hell is going on? One is that the 49ers have the third highest number of incomplete passes due to either drops or inaccurate throws. Because DVOA is basically like an outcome-based metric that basically says, oh, was the pass complete or incomplete? Then it's going to measure that incompletion as a good play for the defense, when in reality, a defender could have gotten beat, and it could just be a terrible Josh Rosen overthrow, or it could be a wide receiver drop, and that goes down as a negative grade in PFF's grading. And so I think that when you think of the execution, it's like, yeah, even when the defense like gets off the field and performs well, it doesn't mean that they're actually doing a good job. And that's what we're seeing consistently with the 49ers. It's not that their defensive calls are putting them in bad positions to succeed, or not putting them in good positions to succeed, I should say. It's that they are not able to execute. And even if they are doing quote unquote good things and getting off the field, it may not even be because they're doing a good job. They're just kind of lucking into that, which is why their overall PFF grade on defense is second worst in the league, ahead of only, I think, like Oakland or Tampa Bay.
I think for the most part, that's, you know, sort of individually looking at each player in a vacuum, that seems like a fairly easy thing to see and suggest. Like, you can sort of take each player as their own individual and you go, this is not a particularly good defense. Like, right, individually looking at these guys, they don't play particularly well. I think the last 2 weeks being able to play, you know, or three of the last, the most recent games are two against the Cardinals, who are not good, and the New York Giants, who are not good. And you know, they've obviously played the Chiefs, who are very good. And the scoring there that they kind of embarrassed this defense with is a whole nother story in terms of just points per game. But looking at their overall DVOA, I don't know that anybody would expect to put them in the middle half of the, or, you know, in the middle of the league, kind of splitting the half there. And overall, their ability to luck out of what appears to be, you know, for the most part, sort of bad overall execution is, it's sort of unfortunate timing, right? Because when you'd love to have that when your team is good, and it's like, oh boy, we're getting off the field at the right time, the ball's kind of bouncing our way, and it's leading to wins, and it's leading to more competitiveness, and possibly a run at the playoffs. But right now, it's like they're lucking into you know, what appears to be a more competitive defense than it actually is, when individually they're not playing particularly well.
You know, and I think especially on defense, I think talent matters a lot more than scheme, where I think the inverse is true on offense. I think outside of quarterback, which you kind of have to have a quarterback, I think you can really scheme players up and really mask a lot of deficiencies on offense. And on defense, it really is just kind of predicated on your talent and the speed at which you're able to play and execute. And I think talent deficiencies are magnified on defense. And when you look at the problems with the 49ers defense, they have some serious talent deficiencies. You've got a complete revamping of a secondary that was already thin at certain positions. I mean, you've got players like Tyvis Powell, Antoine Exum Jr. You've got, you know, those players that are coming in and playing meaningful snaps. DJ Reed ends up giving a touchdown in at the end of the Giants game. I mean, I think Eric Branch had a tweet where he's like, he outlines, you know, oh, so-and-so gets injured, their replacement comes in, they give up a game-winning touchdown. Like, it started with Greg Maben, right? He gives up a game-winning touchdown. And then you've got Tyvis Powell, he gives up a game-winning touchdown. You've got DJ Reed against the Giants, he gives up a game-winning touchdown. It is, just as it is incredibly difficult to win with your third-string quarterback, it's incredibly difficult to win with your third-string safety. And I think that's part of why you're seeing some of these lapses. I think the lapses are less forgivable with players like Jimmy Ward. But when you see Tyvis Powell not play cover two in the red zone very well, it's like, yeah, the guy's maybe played like four games in his whole life. Like, this is probably new for him. That makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, I think even in a completely sound scheme, which I think Robert Saleh's scheme is sound, even if it relies on a bit too many spot drops, I think the execution, when you look at it, is really where the crux of the problem is with this defense. And against the Giants, it reared its ugly head again.
It's tricky because we've seen this scheme work very, very well, both in Seattle and Jacksonville. And both of those teams at the times that they were, you know, or I mean, Jacksonville still is a good defense, but both those teams have or had elite players, you know, up and down their defense. Obviously, many people can name the Seattle defense, but in Jacksonville, they have a phenomenal front with Malik Jackson and Calais Campbell. Miles Jack can really run at linebacker. Telvin Smith is almost the ideal linebacker for this defense. They had Paul Posluszny, who's a very bright inside backer and had a long career. Obviously, Jalen Ramsey at corner. I mean, they had some legit dudes, AJ Boye. So, like, they're set. And while it's great to look at that scheme and go, boy, look what they're able to do with this. They can really make this work. The 49ers just don't have that talent yet. I think what you said as far as, you know, defensive talent really mattering more than scheme, whereas it's the sort of flip is true on offense, is absolutely correct. And it's showing up week in and week out that the 49ers, you know, fair or not, their depth talent just isn't good enough to routinely compete.
And, you know, I don't think that means that you need elite talent for this scheme to work. Like, that's not, I don't know that that's what I'm saying. Is that what you're saying that you need? Because, I mean, I think ultimately you need, you can make anything work with elite talent, right?
Like, correct. Yeah, I'm saying just like even average talent would be fair here. But when you're rotating Tyvus Powell, Greg Maybin, Antoine Exum Jr., even Jimmy Ward, who hasn't had a, you know, crazy successful career, like there's a lack of talent here in the defensive backfield specifically.
Yeah, I mean, you look at some of the best defenses for this year, and you look at the Bears, right? The Bears defense has a lot of phenomenal players. You've got you know, obviously Khalil Mack, but he's not even one of the best players on that team, at least performing so far this season. Eddie Jackson at safety has played a phenomenal year so far. Their corners, Kyle Fuller, Bryce Callahan, also playing very well. Sherrick McManus is also playing very well. They are playing well, and they're getting great performance from one of the most valuable positions in football, which is the cornerback position and the edge rusher position. That's where they're getting their value. And that's the kind of value that you need in today's NFL. When you think of the Niners, when they had a great defense, and Vic Fangio, similar coordinator, right, ran a very, very similar scheme, but they also had phenomenal talent. And it was in a little different area. It wasn't necessarily in the secondary, but they still had, you know, all pro players at every level of that defense. And that's, you know, how you get this combination of like amazing scheme and amazing talent, where you have these complete lockdown defenses. Defense is variable from year to year. It is, for whatever reason, less consistent, especially in these last 2 years, than it has been in years past. I mean, look at Jacksonville. Jacksonville was an amazing team last year defensively, and this year they lose a couple of pieces, and they're not a bad defense by any stretch. They're probably average, middle of the pack, but they're not the same dominant defense that they were last year, and that's in large part because they lost like one or two key pieces at corner. And so the area where I think on defense the Niners really need to shine is an area where they're consistently either getting injured or having lapses or are talent deficient, and that's really beginning to show. And you know, I think if I have to worry about one thing, it's the way that they evaluate talent. And that's not coaching necessarily. That's like giving Malcolm Smith $26 million because that dude didn't have a good game against the Giants. He had a couple of key penalties, one against Saquon Barkley, where he just straight up grabbed him and ended up bailing out the Giants on a 3rd and 17. I'm pretty sure he was the guy who was supposed to be in coverage on Evan Ingram when he started that long reception or started their drive off with that long reception. Both were key plays on the Giants' game-winning drive. Malcolm Smith should not be in a Niners uniform. There's no reason for him to be getting $26 million. And at this point, like, you can't really move on from him because you've paid him so much money. His cap number's too high, and you need the body at this point. It's just not a good body.
It's not at all. Like you said, I mean, they can't really. I mean, I suppose they could take him off the field and put Elijah Lee on, but like you've obviously financially committed to this guy. No one's, you know, there's no trade. Nothing's, no one's taking that contract. You're going to have to release him and eat some money and deal with that. And he's going to have to go somewhere else because at least from a talent evaluation standpoint. And this was like the dude. I mean, when Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch came in, this is like the guy they signed immediately. It was one of the major free agent acquisitions they made to begin. And at the time, it seemed sort of odd because he was coming from Oakland. And, you know, obviously every evaluation department has film on whoever they want, whenever they want. Malcolm Smith didn't play well in Oakland at all. And maybe they were banking on his success in Seattle's scheme, but Seattle at least had elite defensive players around him. So, you know, sort of as you look at evaluation, you wonder, speaking about context, you're like, well, playing next to Bobby Wagner and in front of Earl Thomas and Cam Chancellor, like what, how much does that affect how this guy looks and what he can do? Because now playing next to, you know, Fred Warner, who's not bad, but is a rookie and still learning, and playing in front of Jimmy Ward and, you know, Malcolm Smith doesn't look like it at all. And instead he's a liability on the field. And whether it's execution or understanding of the scheme or whatever it was, he was exploited. And that's what teams do. Like, they look at your work, they look at your defense, they go, who's the guy here that we can get? Who's the guy we can exploit? Oh, let's match up our running back that we selected in the top five on your linebacker that we know that can't move. He's, you know, a vet in the league. He's not playing particularly well, hasn't played particularly well over the last 3 years. So it's curious what the 49ers will do. Well, I'm curious what the 49ers are going to do, because they're going to have to cut bait, but they can't really do it. They're sort of handcuffed here trying to just make it through the end of the season.
So his last 2 years are options. So that means that basically the 2019 season is the last year where it's going to be, where it's going to matter. And his cap hit, if he's cut, basically comes out to like basically $5 or $6 million if he's cut before June 1st.
Yeah. I mean,
which is not nothing, but yeah. I mean, that's, if the cap is raising $10 million a year, roughly, that's basically like the increase in cap that you would get.
Yeah, it's the cost of doing business. Admit the mistake.
Yeah. I don't know that they'll eat that. I mean, at that point, I think you just bench them and at least you have the body and you get someone else. I mean, I don't know what they do. But I think overall, that's the kind of stuff that worries me, like paying Malcolm Smith, playing Earl Mitchell, I think also as well. That's the kind of stuff that worries me, because overall, the scheme, it works just fine. When you look at the two kind of busted coverages that were really, really going to kind of stick in your mind. One was that Mabel call that I described earlier, which is a great call in the red zone. And the Niners were in a position to stop that play. They just didn't have awareness. The other was the throw to Akello Witherspoon, where he's expecting help over the top. And it's basically a cover two shell, which is another not bad call in that area of the field. And if you've got a safety over the top of Akello Witherspoon, you're expecting him to help over the top of Odell Beckham Jr. at that point. And really, again, another lapse. Not a bad call. Not a problem with scheme. That's just a lapse on the defensive player's fault. It's Jimmy Ward, I think. And at that point, you know, what can you do? If I'm Akello Witherspoon, I'm absolutely throwing my hands up. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, I would be so mad and so frustrated to think this is what we're supposed to do. How did you not get that? I absolutely don't care at all that it's a cardinal rule that you're not supposed to show frustration. It's like, no one, Richard Sherman should not be the guy who's talking about keeping your emotions in check and not being demonstrative on the field.
Yeah. And you know, quite frankly, this seems to happen to Akello Witherspoon more than anybody on this defense. So right? He's either very right, like he's the one that's got it, and it's like, damn, this dude can't get the damn help he's expecting, or he's very wrong. I mean, to me, it seems like, you know, this is all this guy knows since he's been in the league. Like, I mean, at some point you're kind of wondering like how, you know, how can he get some help with whatever safety shuffling behind him? Because this is probably 4 or 5 times this year where he's looking around, throwing his hands up. And, you know, obviously Shanahan mentioning that he doesn't want to see him throw his hands up and sort of show that on the field. Like, this is not the first week he's done that. This is 4 or 5 times now. And it's beginning to feel, you know, maybe sort of unfair, because at some point, you know, obviously the coaching staff and the evaluators on in the organization are the ones evaluating. It's not fans. But people are looking at Akello Witherspoon going, this is a mid-round pick. He's supposed to be a starting corner and he's not progressing. And maybe he is, and he's just not getting the help in this scheme like he's expecting. And it's looking like, you know, to the casual fan, it's looking like it's his fault. And in reality, he's doing the best he can, whether it's playing that sort of press man trail technique or expecting some help over the top on some of these, and he's not getting it. And it's got to be really frustrating.
I mean, ultimately, we said this game was going to come down to pressure, both getting pressure on Eli Manning and keeping Mullins upright. the Niners did keep Mullins upright, and the guards had fantastic games. Laken Tomlinson and Person had some of their best interior blocking games of the season. And they, I mean, Nick Mullins did not see pressure a whole hell of a lot. Of course, when he did, he became unfunctional. But he was able to get a couple of really good balls in there, and he had the offense going. I mean, at one point in the third quarter, the Niners had basically like owned the ball for the entire quarter, and it was like, oh, the Giants are going to get the ball back now. And that's one of the reasons why it looked like the game was out of hand. But I think ultimately, on the flip side, the Niners couldn't get pressure on Eli Manning, and Eli Manning is not a good quarterback. But he's good enough to be able to cut you up if you give him all the time in the world. And the Niners' pressure was just not nearly as effective as you would have hoped it would have been, given the state of the Giants' offensive line and given, you know, the fact that you've got a couple of really, really good players along the interior.
The game plan, at least, in my opinion, you know, sort of as you roll into a week facing Eli Manning, a quarterback that you know is at the tail end of his career, and even when he was fully healthy and at his best, Eli Manning is by no means any kind of, you know, athletic passer that's going to be difficult to contain in the pocket. I don't know why they don't, like, this is like a, you know, a blood in the water to a shark. And coming off that great performance against the Raiders, where they, you know, I think obviously we see now says more about the Raiders than the 49ers. But nonetheless, statistically, all those sacks is very exciting. And like, whoa, maybe the 49ers pass rush suddenly has it figured out. You have extra days to prepare to get pressure on Eli Manning. And in addition to that, to get pressure against a weak New York Giants offensive line, obviously not as bad as the Raiders apparently, but by no means, you know, an above average unit, and you fail to do so. I don't know that they, like, sometimes it seems like they get, Saleh gets a little too cute and a little too like comfortable and showy. And at some point it's just like, just, you know, the weakness here, the weakness is go after this quarterback who's got a dead arm and put it on him, because the running back is a good talent regardless of his draft spot. And you know, they've got an elite receiver. So go get after this quarterback and render him useless, because the other two weapons are going to be hard enough to deal with as it is. And they just didn't do it. And whether that comes down to scheme or the coaching, which hasn't lived up to the hype, because they hired a new coach in the offseason, Chris Kiffin, who came over to, or excuse me, not Kiffin. Yeah, Kiffin. So came over to, you know, sort of improve this pass rush, and it just hasn't happened. And they still can't seem to generate the kind of pressure that they need to. The result is you get a quarterback that's not very good. Eli's in probably the bottom quarter of the league right now, just because he can't throw the ball like he used to be able to. And he had no problem. He still looked very comfortable.
I think one correction, incidentally, I was reading the chart. I don't know if the cap wrong. It's not a $6 million cap hit if we release Malcolm Swift next year. It's a $4.2 million hit. There's a $1.2 million savings that the Niners get. So it's basically a net loss, I think, of about $3 million. And $3 million, honestly, is palatable. So
yeah,
at this
that's,
point,
that's
I think,
a no-brainer then.
Yeah, I think you might as well just cut the dude. I think there were bad things happening all across the defense. And in my mind, those are by and large faults of execution, not of scheme. So let's get to spotlight players, because I do want to talk a little bit about what the defense could and should look like if, you know, you're looking to dial up the things that the defense should do to defend, you know, kind of what you're going to need to defend in terms of offenses. But let's get to our spotlight players first, because there were some positive things that happened in this game. I think my spotlight player is surprising, despite the fact that I love Matt Breida. It's going to be one Mr. It's going to be the first time he's been a spotlight player, I think maybe ever, on the Better Rivals podcast, but it's one Mr. Arik Armstead. He had two quarterback pressures and two run stops in just 31 snaps. He is the second highest graded defensive lineman on the team behind DeForest Buckner. And if it were not for Dakota Watson's bonkers game against the Raiders, then he would be the second highest graded player on the 49ers defense behind DeForest Buckner. His pass rushing, while not spectacular, hasn't been a slouch so far. He's 37th in the league in pass rushing productivity, which is, you know, not world beating, but it's not bad. I mean, this puts him in the same category. If you kind of reduce the filter and you're like, all right, give me players that have played at least, you know, like 100 or so snaps or whatever, you're looking at players like Trent Murphy, who plays for Buffalo, Jeremiah Atauchu, who, of course, we cut. J.J. Watt this year hasn't had a phenomenal year, but his pass rushing productivity is 7.4, which is just a little better than Eric Armstead's 6.8 pass rushing productivity. I mean, you're getting production out of this first-round pick, and this is someone who I thought maybe wasn't going to be with the Niners for very long, and I'm thinking at this point, if he keeps playing the way he's playing, I could see the Niners trying to secure him if they can. You know, but you've got a little kind of logjam there on the interior. But if they can, he's actually playing his best football, I think, of his entire career so far this year.
From a pass rushing perspective, you mentioned that he's 37th in the league in terms of pass rushing productivity. When you factor that, you know, there's 32 teams in the league, they're all going to have sort of their guy, and the 49ers, you know, whether that's DeForest Buckner or Cassius Marsh, I still can't say that damn name, but if it's the, what's he call himself, the Panda Bear or whatever his name is.
The Polar Bear.
The Polar Panda Bear, whatever.
The Panda Bear.
if it's
Marsh, I just want to call him the Panda Bear now.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of, yeah. Cuddly and just bamboo eater. If it's Marsh or Buckner, right, that's sort of their dude, to have a secondary option that is Armstead, that's pretty good. That's a productive player. That's someone that you're getting value of. Is it his draft slot, you know, in the teens in the first round? Probably not as good as that. But this is a player, when you throw out some of those names that you mentioned, that, you know, in terms of pass rush productivity, to be in the realm of a guy like J.J. Watt, and obviously it's with a certain number of snaps, and you're looking at career longevity and all that sort of stuff, but to see Armstead really get some pressure and to really sort of perhaps make an impact is encouraging, because D-line depth and rotation is obviously important. These guys play a ton of people every week, and if he can become someone that you can count on, particularly if it's situational and you know where he fits, then that's fantastic. And at the same time, I will mention that, you know, Kyle Shanahan mentioned it in press conferences too, that Eric Armstead was surprisingly absent from that final drive when they needed him the most.
Yeah, no, the rotation's a whole different story. Like, that's, I mean, I get that you want to rotate defensive linemen, but like on the final drive, I don't know why you've got Cassius Marsh and Dakota Watson out there. I mean, I know why, because you feel like you need edge pressure, but you've got to put your best players out there. You really do. And I think that's, you know, that's concerning. But who's your spotlight player this week?
My spotlight player actually is along the defensive line as well, and it's DJ Jones. And really, it's DJ Jones versus Earl Mitchell. In looking at snap counts, Earl Mitchell played just over 20 snaps and DJ Jones just over 10. And obviously, the defensive line is a rotation, and we kind of have dived into that a little bit here already. But the 49ers' commitment to Earl Mitchell is really, really surprising to me. And we've mentioned it before, but more than anything, I think it's becoming more surprising because of who's behind him on this roster and what they can do. The idea that you need this sort of short, squatty nose tackle in the NFL is a fallacy. You don't need that anymore necessarily, and particularly not against some of the teams the 49ers are facing and in terms of what modern offenses in the NFL are trying to do to you. However, DJ Jones is remarkably athletic, and he does offer some of the efficiency and the athletic efficiency that Earl Mitchell just doesn't anymore. And the 49ers' commitment to Earl Mitchell, you know, whether it's a sort of a veteran courtesy that they're letting him continue to get reps or not, the fact that he's routinely getting 22 reps for Earl Mitchell along the defensive line, I don't care how you're playing it, doesn't make sense to me. And even a few weeks ago, we mentioned this idea that Buckner could really play a one technique if you wanted to get Solomon Thomas some more work at three tech. And just when the 49ers defensively, at least, seem to sort of take a step forward in player evaluation and really putting, as you just said, the best 11 on the field, the fact that Earl Mitchell is routinely on the field is really surprising. And if anything, I'd like to see DJ Jones get some more snaps, because you're just not able to see in terms of evaluation what you need. And this is a rookie that's going to go into his third year. Kyle Shanahan recently mentioned that they're trying to figure out who they're going to have moving forward. It's not going to be Earl Mitchell, and that's no slight to him, but that's not a veteran you're re-signing for much money, if anything at all. And at the same time, you have this drafted heavy interior tackle with some athleticism that might actually fit kind of the mold of a Malik Jackson or somebody that you've seen play well on the interior defensive line and in productive schemes and teams elsewhere. And yet they're just not giving him the reps, and it is really confusing to me.
Overall, I think if the kind of takeaway, or not the takeaway, but if where we kind of went with the discussion is what the hell's wrong with the defense, I think it's certainly not going to be 100% on the scheme, because the scheme overall is sound. The plays that are being called make sense for the situations. This is not like some kind of archaic defense. That they are doing things that modern defenses do. It's just the players aren't executing, and it's difficult to execute when you just don't have the talent to execute on a side of the field where talent probably matters more, where playing fast matters more, and being able to read and react matters more than it is or does on offense. And so I think if that's kind of what's wrong with the defense, then, you know, how would you, what do I think we hope the Niners do with their defense, maybe even next year or as the year goes on, to help correct some of this stuff? Because I've been, with all the Niners' defensive lapses, I've been kind of digging more and more into defense and why some of these things are happening and what the calls are. And I think Doug Farrar did a really good job of distilling a lot of these thoughts in a couple of articles that he posted, I think, last week. Did you read any of those kind of pattern match Farrar articles?
I did, yeah. And he did a phenomenal job with that stuff that can be fairly dense, and he put it together in a consumable way that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, if you haven't read these articles, I'm going to post a link to them in the show description. That way you can read them, because I absolutely think you should. But really, it talks about what modern defenses should really be. And so I thought we'd take a moment to kind of define what a modern defense is now, especially with the advent of Pat Mahomes and the Chiefs offense and the Rams and what's happening there. And even to a certain degree, what Kyle Shanahan is doing, there are things that defenses can do to react to what the offense is doing. And I mean, football forever has been, you know, offense does something, defense reacts. Offense does something, defense reacts. And now I think it's time for the defense to react. And the one thing they should do more and more of is pattern matching. You've got, there's a coaching clinic that Nick Saban, that's very, very famous from Nick Saban, where he talks about pattern matching. And he talks a lot about Dan Marino. And he talks a lot about the 1994 defense that he coordinated when he was the defensive coordinator for the Browns. And basically the gist of it is, yeah, you can spot drop. And you can do that, but when Dan Marino is throwing the ball, spot dropping ain't doing shit, because he can basically throw the ball and beat your break, and it's not going to matter because you can't break as fast as Dan Marino can throw the ball. And so he basically adjusted his defense and created effectively a defense that is now known as the pattern match defense. And at a really, really high level, all the pattern match defense is waiting until the offense declares their routes and then matching a player to those receivers to make it look like man coverage once you know what they're going to do. It's basically option defense, where if you know you've got to react off of what the offensive player is doing, and then you react and you end up sticking to your man, so you end up leaving those wide zones and spot drops like you saw the 49ers do in that touchdown pass to Odell Beckham Jr. So that's the kind of the modern defense that you're supposed to do. And it really is a really interesting and neat progression for how it is that he got there.
It really is. And Doug Farrar also just wrote that book, The Genius of Desperation. And it was this idea that, you know, NFL ideas and theories are often brought about because what's happening is not working, or you're being beat by somebody that's quite frankly better. And Dan Marino obviously set the standard in terms of quarterback arm talent, and he could put the ball wherever he wanted to. But what's happening now, and this is trickling down to even the high school and youth levels, is that coaches are able to just design routes to beat that sort of spot dropping coverage. And there's some very, very clear and obvious holes that a quarterback, even at the high school level, many of them can exploit. But at the NFL level, the sort of base arm talent to get into the, you know, to make it to the NFL, we're talking Nick Mullins arm talent, not, you know, Pat Mahomes arm talent. Like, these guys can all throw with the necessary touch to beat, you know, a cover three sort of just spot dropping, whether that's hitting the seams, if it's cover two, you know, just standard cover two, and being able to throw a corner route with some touch and anticipation to the sideline, whatever it is. Most quarterbacks now can do that. And this is born out of the necessity to be able to you know, so not be stagnant and static as an offensive offense attacks you, but rather to be able to adjust on the fly, to pass men off whether based on the route they're running and the depth they're running, and then to match up at the same time in a sort of a pseudo man way where you're not lining up at the line of scrimmage and saying you've got him and you've got him and you've got him, because then offenses will just dictate who gets who and put their best guy on your worst guy. But sort of being able to pass routes off in transition makes it wildly effective. I will say that what you do need to have then is defensive players that understand route concepts. And I think the reason Nick Saban is so successful at this is because he's master at teaching defensive backs to identify accurately the route concepts in motion as they come at them, and understanding sort of fundamentally, like, the NFL gets dressed up in a lot of different ways, but there's some very, you know, common concepts like the smash and the flood and the Yankee and some of these, you know, once you boil it down, there are very core sort of concepts. And when defensive players can identify those, the passing off of these routes gets even easier and really becomes even more of a strategic advantage for them.
Yeah, and I think to your point, the rules for a lot of this are built into the defense and they're built into the calls. And this is why I think, you know, the pattern matching and what defenses could do and should do can become very complex, even though what they're trying to do is very, very simple. The original thing that Nick Saban created in the mid-90s was, you know, the thought behind it was pretty simple. It was, you know, we've got to put an eighth man in the box to stop the run, because that was still a thing back then. And the offense might pass, but when you have eight in the box, you can more or less choose between cover three or cover one. Like, you've got a single high look because you have to have that eighth person in the box. And if you're spot dropping, then, you know, NFL passes are going to basically tear you apart. So you can't really play cover three. And if you can't play cover three, you basically have to play cover one. So, like, where Saban was like, basically, if I'm not going to spot drop, I have to play man coverage across the board single high. But if my defenders aren't as good as the offense's receivers, then I can't play cover one. This is what the Niners were kind of facing early on in the year, where they're just like, you know what? We can't just man up. We have to play zone or some version of it, because their receivers are just better than our defenders. And so if you're in that situation, which is what the Niners are finding themselves in, you can't play cover three because you can't spot drop. And you can't play cover one, traditional cover three. And you can't play cover one because you can't really man up against their players and expect to win. They're going to beat you over and over and over again. Then you've got to figure out a way to combine the elements of zone and man and pattern match. And the Niners do that. The Niners aren't running some kind of archaic, like, 1999 or 1989 defense. They are pattern matching. They do have these rules built into their defense. They still do spot drop a fair amount. And I'd like to probably see a little bit less of that, but they are pattern matching. Seattle pattern matches. I mean, we talked about a pattern match earlier in this podcast, the Mabel pattern match. I think the problem, though, is that pattern matching requires communication with your defense, and you've got to pass people off, and you've got to make an undercall, and that undercall from a cornerback lets the second linebacker know that he's responsible for the guy running underneath. Well, guess what? If your defensive back doesn't make that call, now your linebacker busts the coverage because he's not expecting that receiver to get into his zone. You know, and so it gets really, really complicated. And if you're not communicating, then things begin to break down. And I think that's where the Niners are, is the youth and inexperience in their backfield is preventing them from executing some of the things that Saleh's asking them to do.
It also takes a tremendous amount of sort of knowledge and consistency, right? Much like an offensive line, you know, you want that continuity, consistency, so that those players can pass off line stunts and things like
that.
Great
analogy.
It's very similar with defensive backs, and, you know, understanding what kind of speed your guy has and whether that corner has enough length and speed to really, if he's, you know, if they're playing that sort of cover two pattern matching, can that corner really sit? Where does he have to sit in the flat to be able to, you know, have enough length to defend a corner or at least help you on a corner route and at the same time drive downhill on a speed out or whatever it may be? This necessity to have some continuity that the 49ers just haven't had for a variety of reasons this year and last. When they have it, I think that you will see the scheme start to tighten up a little bit, and you'll see increase or you'll see an improvement because of the continuity and the communication and sort of the trust that can be built and developed when instead of eight different players playing in the secondary in the first 10 weeks, it's only four.
Yeah. Now, we were talking a little bit about pattern matching beforehand, and you teach pattern matching to your high school team, don't you?
I do. Yeah. We run a sort of a cover two pattern matching system.
Yeah. And cover two pattern matching is what Vic Fangio ran with the Niners, and it's what he currently runs with the Bears, because Nick Saban started out with a cover three pattern match, but then eventually with the advent of spread, he basically was like, yeah, I don't know that I need that eighth person in the box. I actually need another safety deep. And now it's become kind of a match quarter system, which incidentally, I have the Coach's Choice Alabama match quarters DVD sitting on my coffee table that I'm excited to watch. I think I'm going to try and watch it this bye week since there's no
good stuff. Yeah, on. I have a book called Cautious Aggression about matching quarters and sort of the how that's built out of the Big 12 and their necessity. I'll send it your way. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Actually, we should probably do, I'd be up for doing a match quarters episode sometime in the near future, maybe even for ski month, although that's quite a ways away.
Yeah, I'm so in.
How do you, really quickly, is there a way that you teach kind of some of the basic pattern matching concepts to your high school kids? Because this is, yes, it can get very complicated and convoluted, but at its core, it's really not. High school defenses do run this because they face spread offenses on the reg. So is there anything that you use to kind of as a teaching mechanism to help your kids learn the kind of cover two pattern match?
Yeah, absolutely. So at its base level, we play really a 3-4 with a two high shell, cover two shell. And we ask our outside linebackers to widen out if we're facing sort of just a ace 2x2 formation. We ask them to widen out just inside of the twos on both sides. Again, counting from outside in, 1-2 on both sides. As we ask them to widen out just inside of, to be just inside and about 5x5. And what happens on the snap is we ask them to wall two, which is essentially don't let the two receiver get inside of you immediately, you know, redirect that route somehow and read his break. If two goes, sort of the base rule we have, if two goes outside, runs an outbreaking route in the first 5 yards beyond the line of scrimmage, you snap your eyes to the one, meaning immediately find the one receiver on the same side and see what he's doing. Because in terms of matching concepts, very rarely our offense is going to have two guys go to the same area. So an outbreaking route from the two receiver might correlate with a slant from the one or something of that variety. So you're going to snap your eyes to one and find him. And oftentimes you're matching a slant coming inside or whatever it may be. If you're the corner, your eyes are inside on the offensive tackle. When the offensive tackle pass sets, you snap your eyes to two as well. If the two runs an outbreaking route within the first 5 yards, we say you sit, which is you sit in the flat and you prepare to take that outbreaking route. Now, if the two runs that outbreaking route and then runs a wheel, you are now locked onto him in man. So that two, as he makes that outbreaking route coming into your flat area as the corner, you match up with him in man now. And the safety is seeing the exact same thing. The two's going out in the first 5 yards. So he does what we call oh shit, which is essentially open up your outside hip and run over the top of one as hard as you can, expecting that many teams run similar concepts like a speed out and fade and that sort of thing. So you're getting over the top of the one receiver potentially running a vertical route. And at its base, That's really it. Now, you've got to rep the snot out of it because high school students need to be able to communicate and understand, again, like matching those past concepts. But it's wildly effective when kids understand it because they're able to really play anything coming at them.
You know, and I think that there was a whole hell of a lot there. And I think you probably summed it up perfectly when it's like you have to rep the holy hell out of it. Because I think when I look at the Niners defense as a whole, I'm still waiting for some kind of equilibrium where they have a core set of players where they can rep concepts over and over and over again, where they can then feel like they know how to operate as one unit, like you said, an offensive line. And I don't know that the Niners have gotten there yet, in part because of injury and in part because of just acquisitions from, you know, what we've needed to do in order to bolster talent. And so I think that overall, when I look at what's going on with the defense, it's certainly not a, you know, problem with you know, Salah's scheme, it's not a bad scheme. I think that there's probably just a problem with the way they've been able to implement it. And yes, some of that probably falls on the coach. And I think you mentioned Jeff Hafley's name earlier, and I think you're probably right. If the Niners are looking to move on from something, they'll probably find another defensive backs coach. But I don't know that the Niners are going to move on from Robert Saleh. I don't know that he's become the fall guy for the Niners' defensive woes right now. And I think there's a little bit of merit to that, but it's probably way overblown. I think at this point, you're looking at a defense that is operating with inferior talent, with a scheme that requires a ton of communication, that team is just, for whatever reason, not been able to communicate effectively. And this is why you're seeing lapses repeatedly and over and over and over again. And, you know, I don't know if they're going to make changes, but if they do, I hope that it's more towards, you know, kind of more modern concepts and more modern things, because now the NFL is at a place where they're stealing concepts from high school. They're stealing concepts from college. And I think if they can steal some of these concepts and how they get implemented, I think the Niners defense will be better for it.
It will. I think, you know, at the root, this scheme can work. And Robert Saleh, you know, may deserve more time. I think he does deserve more time to sort of really implement it with a consistent defensive backfield and with, you know, the legitimate players that they see fitting in this scheme long term, because they began last year with Rashard Robinson as their number one corner, and he's gone. And you know, now this year they've got Richard Sherman and Akella Witherspoon, and they're still trying to piece this together, I think. And as you mentioned, you know, there is this need to remain modern and to continue to sort of progress at the same rate that defenses and offenses are on both sides of the ball throughout the league. And at the same time, with a forward-thinking head coach like Kyle Shanahan, and, you know, an offense that Robert Saleh is having to prepare to practice against often, or, you know, at least is in meetings with and understands, you know, in terms of offensive philosophy, he understands how Kyle Shanahan works. And I'm sure Kyle Shanahan can tell Saleh exactly how he works and what, you know, the sort of things that he needs to be prepared for. This is a scheme that can work fundamentally, that is, it is at the forefront of, you know, NFL knowledge and schematics. It's not like Saleh's stuck back in the 70s and the 49ers just aren't advanced, but they're at a sort of installation level where they just don't have the necessary reps and communication that you've got to have to run this at a high level. And that just takes time. And it might be something where the, you know, the last few weeks of the season, you see a group that's really remained together for 4 or 5 weeks start to gel before the end of the year.
All right, man. Well, that was fun. I think that about does it for this week. We are probably going to do a little bonus episode because we're probably not going to record during Thanksgiving, but we'll try and do a little bonus episode this weekend if we can pull it together. But if we're dark for a week, it's because we're stuffing our face with the turkeys and drinking all the things and just not thinking about another Womp Womp Wednesday, I think, waiting for a Turkey Thursday. But Jared, where can they follow you on the Twitters?
You can find me on Twitter at @JaredBrown_. That's J-E-R-O-D Brown_.
And you can follow me at Better Rivals. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. And, as always, go Niners.
I'm Spencer Hall from SB Nation, and I want to tell you about my new show, It Seemed Smart. It Seemed Smart is a show about people doing things that, for some reason or another, seemed smart at the time. Those things might include doing a little cocaine and driving a bike up a mountain. Or, I don't know, maybe racing 100 miles per hour across the country in the middle of the night with no one's permission. Or even stealing a bat from an umpire's room in a Major League Baseball park. Check it out, and if you like it, tell a friend. I'm Spencer Hall. Don't do anything smart.